At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And here's where C.S. Lewis says this is where this kind of story can be bad. We're trying to dumb it down, but I think we're too dumb to dumb it down, you know?
That's true.
C.S. Lewis specifically says this, which makes me think he would be a fan of the Rambler rating system.
What if all people in tech support were actually furries?
Sci-fi. Welcome back, everybody, to another Toot Ramble episode. I am one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
And I just kind of climbed with my hands going taller and taller until I was like bursting with Austin. I don't know. It was a strange introduction, this one.
You're bursting?
Why don't you know? You never focus on the Austin, always the bursting.
Generally, when you say Austin's bursting, I'm focusing on the bursting word.
What a way to start a literary analysis of a very intelligently written article by C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, that's appropriate for this channel.
Very appropriate.
Let's take something highbrow, academic, and well thought out, and let's
bash it with hammer.
Bash it with a wrench. We're not smart enough to use the proper tool for the job.
Also, we're not bashing this article. We're trying to analyze it. We're saying like we're using sticks because we're cavemen was the analogy. Like we are trying to understand something that is greater than us.
We're not a good this, are we?
We're talking about we're talking about an article that C.S. Lewis wrote back in 1955 called On Science Fiction.
I think it'd be more appropriate to say it's an essay.
Essay. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. Essay/slash article. He was talking about other articles in this essay. Yeah. So he's treating it as some sort of essay article where he decided to write this, and we'll get into the background of, I guess, first why we're doing this episode in the first place. Rich?
My mother sent me an article saying, hey, check this out. I think it's neat. And I said, yeah, it is neat. It's a very interesting article. Mm-hmm. And so the article talks about C.S. Lewis's essay on science, which him going through the idea of what is science fiction, what genres of science fiction, which ones are valuable, which ones aren't, which ones does he think have merit, and what does it entail?
Defining what is the genre.
Exactly.
And especially back in the 1950s, where it's relatively more new. I mean, Frankenstein came out well before then, but it was his kind of work, and he's writing this in 1955. And at this time, to give some context, C.S. Lewis published Narnia from 1950 to 56, the series there. He's writing this in 1955. And for more context, Lord of the Rings was published in 1954 and 55. So it's right around that time before Lord of the Rings became what it is, before even Narnia became what it is. But C.S. Lewis is writing this article. And as he begins, I guess, before we dissect it, talk about it, there's a lot of, I think, useful information for both us and people wanting to listen in of how to define the genres. What were your thoughts beforehand on what makes science fiction, what makes fantasy, what makes speculative fiction as a thing?
We have talked about this before, of trying to define the difference between science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah.
And we basically came to the conclusion of a simple definition.
Our sticks and stones type of
explanation, where fantasy deals with a fictional story of the impossible. A science fiction story is a fictional story of the improbable.
Mm-hmm.
Improbable versus impossible.
That was our
definition. This goes into much more detail on different subgenres, and specifically talking about a difference between a setting versus a story. That's a lot of its difference.
Yeah.
Where is sci-fi a particular setting where you tell another type of story, or is sci-fi its own type, like it necessitates, the setting of sci-fi necessitates a certain type of story, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get into that a little bit more.
We will. And just the impossible versus improbable, we didn't come up with that. No. Just to clarify, like that's what we think, because I think Sanderson said this, many other authors have said this, mm-hmm. as a cool delineation to kind of think, oh, okay, that's whatever type of science-y thing that could be a possibility in the future we considered science fiction. And a lot when we're reading this article too, this is in 1955, and now we're filming this in 2024. So how much did what he's looking at science fiction change from then to now? Does it still hold up? Does mm-hmm. it still a good way to describe, as he puts it, the subspecies of sci-fi? So that'd be a whole nother thing. So Rich, also last point before we go into the article officially, your mom has now given us several video ideas.
Yeah.
She's a content machine. She should be our, I don't know what position in this she has, but she has it.
She's our video idea consultant.
Ah.
Yes.
No, I don't like that, because you have to pay consultants a lot. They charge up the wazoo.
I pay her with phone calls and hugs.
Okay.
That's what I pay.
Satisfactory. That's why family's cheap, you know? It's great. You can always get a family favor.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So, article time?
Article time.
So, if you guys want to go read the article, go check it out. We're going to summarize it, break it down, essay. We're going to break this essay down. Starting with, why did C.S. Lewis write this thing in the first place?
Basically, the time that he's writing this, there was starting to be a big boom in science fiction, where science fiction did exist, but at the time they wrote this essay, it became a lot more popular. And you started to see a lot more stories in the sense of your Star Wars type stories, or maybe your Flash Gordon-esque stories.
What a way to put it. I don't know, about that, but yeah.
You're getting what I mean. Yeah, there's a lot. It became a popular genre mm-hmm. when he wrote this essay, and he's talking about, hey, now it's relevant. Which of these subgenres is actually, you know, worth its merit, or which is not? So,
and even more so, what he was saying, science fiction's gotten popular, and he's read other articles. He's read other people's opinion pieces. In 1955, he was reading other people's and going, they're talking about a subject matter that they don't love. Often he was seeing a lot of critics, the people online, I guess back in the day, not online, but on page. He was talking about these other writers and other opinion pieces and critics talking about science fiction in a more highbrow, pretentious way, and would look down on the genre because they didn't love it inherently. Yeah. Where C.S. Lewis was reading their articles, and he says this is in the first part of his essay, of talking about how all these other people are, as he says, this is a quote from the article, which we'll do quite often in this episode. So he says, I don't like detective stories, and therefore all detective stories look much alike to me. If I wrote about them, I should therefore infallibly write drivel. And so he's making this point to say he doesn't like detective stories. He's not going to say a word about it, but sci-fi is C.S. Lewis's thing, and he doesn't think the other people are giving it the respect it deserves, basically, in modern lingo. He's going to put respect on this name.
Thing is, he makes a very valid point when talking about criticism of really any type of genre.
Yeah.
If you're criticizing something and you notice that you're criticizing the entire genre of work, where you can't even find, say, for us, mm-hmm. romanticy. General romanticy for us is not a genre we like. I can't really think of a romanticy book that I have enjoyed. And so my criticism of it is not particularly valid, or it's really not worthwhile as much, where real good criticism comes typically from a place of love, because if you happen to love a genre, you know what's good. And so if you know what's good, you can identify what's bad. But if you only see the bad, then you have no comparing contrast to actually pull from.
It's what our favorite Terry Pratchett does. He parodizes fantasy because he loves fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
You're able to parody something you love. And same thing with criticism.
It's a general thing. It's a great point he makes. Jokes. Jokes mainly go over very well from a place of understanding. And if you don't understand or you don't like something, it's really hard to make a good joke about it.
Yeah. Also with us, and when we talked about Fourth Wing, when we talked about ACOTAR, we'll do the second book of ACOTAR, that series eventually. Yeah. But both of those, I think we did the right approach where we had more fun with it. We knew it wasn't for us, so we just had fun with it. When it's a fantasy or sci-fi book we don't like, we'll get passionate of like Name of the Wind. We'll get passionate and go, No, well, this is my genre, and I didn't like this and this.
That's exactly
because we care about the genre.
We love the genre, so we can actually give good criticism on it rather than romanticism, where we can say what didn't work for us, but it's generally, we're not going to have anything poignant to say on that book specifically.
It'll be like a percent less drivel than we would have done otherwise. As C.S. Lewis, he says drivel a couple times in this essay, I think. So yeah. I think it's a good, that's the theme of this, not the essay, it's a theme of our review of the essay. Also, at the end, how ironic would it be we give a star rating to an essay talking about criticism?
4.5.
It is. So if you are all wanting to read this before checking out the rest of the video, you don't have to. You could do it in either order. I think you'll get the same out of it. But just to be clear with this, I think overall opinions on the article, I want to read C.S. Lewis now because it's written fantastic. It's written amazingly, fantastically. Mm-hmm. And also, I think our bulk opinion, we talked about this briefly before, articles also makes a ton of sense, except there's a last section which we'll try to dissect, which gets a little confusing.
I think that one's going to require the most amount of discussion between you and I to understand it, because I don't particularly get it.
Okay.
Even I read that section like 2-3 times, and I'm still not quite clear.
We'll get there then.
Yeah.
Because that's just the intro of why he's writing the essay. He's talking about, hey, I want to actually analyze what science fiction is. And this is where he gets into it. He defines his subspecies of sci-fi. There's 5 he lays out, possibly a 6th, maybe 7th, depending on how you take the last answer to if it. So there's 5 for sure. And then there's a little bit of gray area in the end that he leaves. Mm-hmm. Want to talk about the first one?
Let's go.
This is C.S. Lewis's first subspecies of science fiction. He calls it fiction of the displaced persons. As I put it, because he said this word already, the drivel, the theme.
Yeah, this is the stuff that he puts as, yeah, it's technically sci-fi, but it's the lowest form of sci-fi. And he mainly says it's the lowest form of sci-fi because necessarily the story itself does not require the sci-fi setting, in which case it is wasting the title of sci-fi. And for him, that is the worst. That's the worst case scenario.
To quote the man, he says, "I think radically bad." He does not like it.
Yeah.
Not one
basically
bit.
If you'd write a standard detective story, but now it's in space, you didn't need to tell your story in space, and therefore a waste of people's time. You might as well just tell it in the real world, where the point of sci-fi is like it could only be told in that genre.
Right, because when we were talking to Ken Liu, he said this, the stories that fascinate him are, I want to see Earth from the perspective of a satellite.
Yeah.
That sci-fi can do that, where you can now put a new perspective on something from some impossible or improbable element to make it amazing. So, and your entire point that of the breakdown of what he's going for here, of what is this type of story he's talking about, he says in quotes, "I am then condemning not all books which suppose a future widely different from the present, but those which do so without a good reason, which leap 1,000 years to find plots and passions which they could have found at home." Saying, why make it sci-fi when all you did was tell this kind of story with no of the sci-fi substance?
Yeah, exactly.
It was just a veneer of
an that absolute, ultimately is kind of distracting, where he does talk a little bit about a dichotomy difference of the difference between the character and the story, and where he talks about where if someone's looking to look at if the focus is the character, the story itself is a bit more muted. It's a little bit, it's not as crazy. And so that way you can focus on the character versus if you have a extraordinary crazy plot, you typically have a less crazy, less interesting character. That way the focus stays on the plot. If you have both, I think he brings up a great example of Alice in Wonderland.
This is all in a later section.
Later section?
All that is.
Never mind. I was going to connect it to this.
Oh, yeah. No,
mainly being
that stuff he likes, or likes more than this. The stuff he
doesn't
like.
I'm giving
the
example of like, it's not worth it. Where you're putting you're telling a standard story in a sci-fi setting, and ultimately the sci-fi setting can actually be distracting to the story you're actually supposed to be telling, which could better take place at home.
Yeah, he. Do you agree with him on that point of, hey, if you're just wasting the sci-fi fantasy element,
yes,
you don't like it?
Yeah. That is generally what I think. And this is, now, do I go as hard-pressed as him of, like, it's drivel?
Radically
probably,
bad,
I'm not I'm not that radical on that opinion.
Yeah.
But I generally do find it a waste of...
Mm.
And this was my original opinion of Red Rising until it got into the sci-fi stuff.
Yeah.
Where I, when I book first one. Saw book one, when I first was thinking, this is just like Hunger Games in space.
You mean just a masterpiece, but I'll let it go. I'll let it pass.
Thing is, that's only part of it. And then even in that book, you start getting into the more sci-fi stuff where you go, okay, there's
the
a reason why it,
and...
there's a reason why it's taking place in the future and it justifies its genre. But there are plenty of examples where I don't know if I particularly like when sci-fi is used only as a setting.
What examples come to mind?
Honestly, a lot of different TV shows type of
TV
thing.
TV shows, though, yeah.
To some degree, Star Wars for me is... Eh. I like it well enough, but there are some elements to it where it's a standard hero's journey story where it's fun, but it's not as good for me. I guess it's not the best example.
Maybe you're looking for a difference of originality versus...
Sure.
Like using wasting the sci-fi setting.
Honestly, many episodes of Doctor Who. Doctor Who can, on one hand, can be very good at telling a very interesting story with sci-fi, but then often quite literally just have, hey, what if we had the murder on the Orient Express, but in space? And it's literally just that. That's all it is. Kind of a waste.
Mm.
It's a waste of the sci-fi setting.
Got it. If it's not adding any new value.
Yeah.
It's very hard, I think, to find a book that really follows this, because you'd have to really hate that book, because even Red Rising, for your example, Empire Silence, for me, I didn't like the first book, but it would still be a poor example. It's not what he's talking about.
Exactly.
Because
he's talking about a lot of... Because I'm even trying to remember the names of some of these books.
Yeah.
That it reminds me of... Lost in Space, I would say, falls pretty clearly under it. Of it's a sci-fi setting, but all of the stories along inside of it are just a mystery or kind of regular drivel stories. But guess there's a robot and you're in space. It's basically it.
Maybe one of the closest this would get to that, a story we both love, All Systems Red, would get the closest, where it's just generic sci-fi, but I love the element of it's a sentient AI that is misanthropic and uses the tool of having that robot's perspective. So it uses the genre really well. It's very light on the... Go ahead.
Yeah. If the robot was more standard.
Right, just there.
It does just enough of the character's perspective is unique in the sci-fi that you can't tell that story as well.
And
you
Martha
can't have
Wells,
that character's perspective in a modern time.
Right. Martha Wells does it there exquisitely, I'd say.
Exquisitely.
And just to cap this off, the first subspecies he's talking about, this displaced persons is what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I presume that the authors of such stories are, so as to speak, displaced persons, commercial authors who did not really want to write science fiction at all, but who availed themselves of its popularity by giving a veneer of science fiction to their normal kind of work. So exactly this, where I think part of his criticism of fellow critics, of not those critics talking about a subject which they do not love, he sees this section of sci-fi, authors who don't actually love sci-fi but are doing it because of its popularity, or kind of going on to the bandwagon of what's selling rather than the author wanted to write a sci-fi story and had something to say.
I think the best way to be able to identify it yourself is if you can describe a book, story, movie, TV show as blank but in space, it's probably one of these stories where the only sci-fi element to it is it's in space or it's in the future, but the story itself is not particularly you could have the exact same story in the present day.
So if you said Hunger Games but in space, you've said that so many times, I'm feeling very insulted right now.
You should.
So you overall agree with that, his first categorization? Maybe not just that's how you categorize things, but his opinion on that species, that subgenre of sci-fi.
Yeah. And okay. To some degree, that's how the series of Red Rising can sometimes feel for me. Of when it talks about, like, for me, the idea of the laser sword. So, like, you know, the sling blade to me is just, or the grav boots to me is just like, that's not the sci-fi that I know of where it goes, like, those are necessary for a plot detail rather than just like, oh, it's kind of cool
stuff. Sling blades are badass.
Yeah. I don't know. It makes it feel more of a setting and backdrop rather than a necessary tool.
That's the thing, too. And we'll talk about, as we go on, from 1955 to now, how this has changed or what sci-fi is now. But when talking about just genre, C.S. Lewis isn't saying that in the library you need a displaced person sci-fi subgenre to go pick up books that are this drivel he's talking about. Where if we're just talking genre for something like Red Rising or Dune, whatever... we're talking about this with a friend of ours, Harry, where genre is two things usually. There's genre of setting and genre of tone, where when you go to pick something up, is sci-fi could be sci-fi is the setting. So sci-fi setting with what's the tone? Is it horror? Is it comedy? Is it what have you? So a lot of that is just when you go to pick up a book, you're going, okay, what's the setting? What's the tone? Is what is useful for us. I think C.S. Lewis, I would assume he's going into not genre, but he uses the word subspecies, not genre.
Yeah.
So he's talking about sci-fi and like some things he's noticed and trends at the time. So
sure.
Do you want to go into number two?
Yeah.
Number two, this is the second one. How about you say this one?
Yeah. So the fiction of engineers, which I do love. This is probably my favorite type of sci-fi, arguably. But to quote the man himself.
Yes.
C.S. Lewis said, I do not have the slightest taste for it myself.
So
it is written by people who are primarily interested in space travel or in undiscovered techniques as real possibilities in the actual universe. And they give us an imaginative form of their guesses as to how the things might be done. Best example for this is The Martian. And,
Fire Upon the Deep is another amazing
Fire Upon one. The Deep and the Project Hail Mary. All of those are great fiction of engineers because they all deal with really the problem, like, hey, let's go into the minutia of how exactly would this work and going into those little fantastical but improbable details.
Mm.
And the focus is the tech, how it would be done.
Right. So I love it. For you, I think the difference with the first subspecies C.S. Lewis is talking about in the second is you would want to know, how do the grav boots work?
Exactly.
How does the sling blade its sling?
The reason why I like Empire of Silence, the setting of it, more than I do Red Rising, even though I would, again, very different stories where, at the very least in the first book, I like Red Rising more than I like Empire of Silence.
Ooh.
In the first book?
Wow.
Now, series later on, different story. Mm-hmm. But as of the first book, the story is more interesting in Red Rising than in Empire of Silence. But the world and the setting is far more detailed.
Where they talk about the cryos. Aspect.
Like, okay, how do they fly across the stars? In Red Rising, we get in a spaceship, we go. Okay.
Well, they don't in book one.
But they talk like, hey, how do we go to other planets and things like this? But again, the overall setting is, hey, how does the sword work? Like, it's a sling blade. Okay, flexible plasma, whatever. It's not really gone into. The grav boots, well, they put the boots on, they can fly. That's it. Empire of Silence goes deep into, okay, they actually have to go into cryofreeze during long space flight. But rather than just, oh, they go cryosleep. No, they go into the detail of, no, actually, you remove all of the blood from your veins and put in this fantasy antifreeze stuff that basically preserves you. So then you store the blood and everything on site. Then you can actually be filled to the brim and be frozen solid.
Mm-hmm.
All of these details, then their version of a lightsaber has actually gone into a little bit more detail of why it works, different metals that can't be cut by it, goes into those details, which I love. I love those details.
So the function of how the gadgets work is something that you cling on to. Whereas the first book of Red Rising, and we're not spoiling these books. These are soft stuff. And that doesn't explain the grav boots or the sling blade is described in how it works. We don't know how it's built.
It's not necessarily if it's described or not. It's a lot of it is what's the focus.
Mm-hmm.
So
the focus on Red Rising is, since it's the color system and they're talking about how the golds only eat some of their food at the plate because it would be seen as gluttonous to complete your plate. You need to be higher than these other lower class of you. You need to show some prestige. It's more about the conflict between these different, literally different types of Homo sapiens in the world of Red Rising.
Sure. And
so it goes more into that engineering aspect, but again, that's not the type of engineering where he's describing space travel, technique, something in the actual universe. So culture versus tech.
Yeah, and so also, I believe you could tell the first book of Red Rising in modern day pretty easily. You just have caste system of, you know, person of low rank basically disguises the higher rank and infiltrate. And this, you could pretty easily tell it, and it's mostly cultural differences. And
the element of like literal humans are literally have different capabilities, like stronger, smarter.
The first book, not nearly as much. It could just be because thing is, we have other stories of exactly that, of the people who are at the top of the hierarchy. They've had better training. They have better food. And it is mostly social engineering aspect of it. You don't need to add too much to it. Later on into other books, you definitely need it to be more sci-fi heavy.
What would you say for something like Dune and the engineering of Dune?
Now that's fascinating because it reads like a fantasy book, but is the bones of Dune or a sci-fi book. You know what I mean? The tone is often fantasy.
Like when you say, we'll stop using this example, Red Rising, people call it like sci-fantasy because it doesn't go into the sci-fi as much as something like Dune does. And when we're saying sci-fi, I guess what we're talking about is this fiction of engineers, the second subspecies C.S. Lewis is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say Dune, everyone goes, clearly that's sci-fi, right?
Yeah.
But why do you think that comes to mind so easily? Why do some people call Red Rising sci-fantasy, but then Dune or Your Empire of Silence so clearly sci-fi?
I mean, a lot of that is the details. What's the focus?
Yeah.
So specifically when C.S. Lewis is talking about the fiction of engineers, the focus of the entire story is on the machines of like, how would this work? Like, how would we get space travel to actually work? And let's break it down. And that's the focus of the whole story.
Great example is Fire Upon the Deep, where it's the whole focus of Fire Upon the Deep is what if the singularity happens where an AI becomes more powerful than humans?
And basically, what would happen? What would necessitate, because he was talking about how basically singularity happens, there is no chance of human survival. Like, how could humans
exist
in something like the singularity actually happening?
And constructed a
universe in which humans and the singularity could both exist at the same time.
Very light on the sci-fi.
Yeah.
Jules Verne said, I'm only right. Every sentence of that book was sci-fi.
Exactly.
Just, by a the way, have we don't talk about it enough, five-star world. If I could give 6 stars, that I think, hot take, hot take. I don't even know if it's a hot take. Might be my favorite world in fiction over time. It just sat with me.
Wow.
Not
Dune?
I think Dune is
pretty damn close of one of the best sci-fi worlds.
It's still 5 stars.
Like Arrakis.
Still 5 stars, but preference-wise, I'm taking Fire Upon the Deep.
That's fair. Oh, it's a good one.
The Tines and... Oh, okay. Recommendation. Go read that book. If you are into sci-fi space operas. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's increased over time. I love it so much. Okay.
But to the point where C.S. Lewis doesn't actually talk too much about this genre because he's not that interested in it. But he acknowledges that it's a very valid form.
Yep.
It's just he can't really critique it since he's not interested in that genre. So he would have nothing but drivel to offer.
But he gives some examples. So he says Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Wells' Land Ironclads, and Arthur Clarke's Prelude to Space. Those are some examples, and we've said some of our examples as well. Now, the third subspecies of C.S. Lewis's description of science fiction itself, he says the scientific but speculative is how he describes this one. And we might call this sort of fantasy today, in a way.
Sure.
So, depending on the book. But do you remember what he's getting into on this subspecies?
Yeah, it's basically taking something that does exist today, either in mythos or in some type of history, and then going, what if? Mm-hmm. So I think he's talking about, he gives a couple of little examples in the essay, talk about what would Hades be like if you were to go there alive, which is Homer's, Homer sends Odysseus there.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why that is not, to him, completely like fantasy is, Homer is taking something that already existed, the idea of Hades.
Yeah.
And then added a what if question to it. It's not completely made up from him. Like, he didn't make it completely up.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the line that he's drawing, where something like J.R.R. Tolkien's world is completely made up from him, which has, other than the concept of potatoes, has no direct connection to Earth. Nothing.
Well, the fact that it's called Middle Earth is maybe the other connection. But other than that.
Other than that, okay. Other than not potatoes and it's called Middle Earth, it's not our world.
Completely new. Whereas you're exactly, he's saying, what if, another example he says is, what would it be like if you could go to the center of the Earth?
Yeah.
And Dante's Inferno talks about the layers of hell. So what if this happens? And exploring that what if to its, a story you couldn't just do in nonfiction, because you have to take a step into the not real, because you're another one. He says, what would it be like to walk among those mountains that under that black crowded sky? Hey, what would it be like to live on the moon? What would it, all these type of questions?
Mm-hmm.
And he says specifically, this is more what you were talking about in the first one. This is where he talked about this in the essay, where he says this subspecies is more impossible than the engineer stories. The engineer stories we just talked about, C.S. Lewis is saying, hey, this is, how would time travel actually work? How would this gadget actually work if it was possible? This one, he says, in quotes, the more plausible, the worse this subspecies is. The more plausible, the worse. And the reason that is what you were getting about the Alice and...
Ah, yes. Yeah. So I'll actually bring it up again, where... Yeah. In this type of story, when you're asking this what if question in this fantastical manner, where typically the story is very odd, weird, crazy, you want a character that is normal to be able to contrast.
Your straight man.
Exactly. Yeah. You need the straight man to your story. So Alice in Wonderland, Alice is a very normal girl and very mild-mannered normal girl in a crazy Wonderland. And if Alice herself was a very in-depth, interesting character and, depth and crazy herself, it would be too much for the story. He also gives another example. Do you reminded me of it? There was Alice in Wonderland.
He did give one more example. I didn't write it down in my notes. There was one more example he gave, but we could come up with other examples. So most stories, too, when you have character going in, normal character, crazy world, it's more fantasy, but Discworld. Going into absurd world. And
somewhat, but sometimes he does add...
Sometimes quirky.
Often the crazy person is changing the normal world in Discworld. Like it's either a normal character in a crazy situation in Discworld, or it's a crazy person changing the status quo of Discworld, which... Discworld's already baseline crazy, but like you can get crazier.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Anyway. Yeah, I get what you mean. Yeah, yeah. But then, this wouldn't be in this example because this is the what if, and Tolkien's not a what if. He creates something of his own, but Bilbo.
Yeah.
Is that you have a lot of these protagonists that walk into a situation, and in order, he says this in quotes, to tell how odd things struck odd people is to have an oddity too much. He who is to see strange sights must not be strange himself. That exact point of to have the reader understand, like, know how weird and crazy this stuff is. The person experiencing it has to, in this subspecies, to be just as normal
as Wonderland would not be
wonderful, and
Wonderland would not be crazy from the Mad Hatter's perspective.
Yeah, it's just normal. A home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you wouldn't tell it from his perspective.
And C.S. Lewis specifically says this, which makes me think he would be a fan of the Rambler rating system. You know, I think today, I can say that actually. C.S. Lewis would support the Rambler rating system.
Exactly. Let's put words in his dead mouth.
God, that's grim. This is what he says. This is what he said. He says, "It is absurd to condemn them," and he's talking about these stories, "because they do not often display any deep or sensitive characterization. They oughtn't to. If it is a fault if they do. Wells, Cavour, and Bedford have rather too much than too little character. Every good writer knows that the more unusual the scenes and events in his story are, the slighter, the more ordinary, the more typical his person should be." And I think why he'd like the Rambler rating system is when we're rating categories, characters, then world, and you know, we delineate. We go, hey, the characters here, you know, not the best characters, but they were serviceable. 3 stars. It's not going for it.
Exactly.
You could still give the overall book 5 stars.
Exactly.
It's just going for 3 stars in the character. Just like C.S. Lewis is saying, hey, to make the world that it's going for 5 stars, you can have your 3-star character, your 5-star world, and still a 5-star book.
Well, yeah. Think about a book like A Fire Upon the Deep on how insane that world is and how crazy it is.
Oh, it's amazing.
If you had crazy characters, like, it would take away a little bit. Like, those characters are the straight man to this world.
They're normal.
And they're very, like, normal person enter the world. And then, even then, like, the Tynes are kind of a main character-ish sometimes. And they're crazy.
But the kids are normal.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're...
There's a bit of both.
There's a little bit.
It's definitely... That one's definitely more to the engineers category, because I think he's... exploring yes. that, but this
but
one
it's an
has
example
your...
of just the rule of if you have a crazy world, mm-hmm. you probably should have a normal person, a normal character.
Right.
Crazy character, normal world.
What would you say some examples of this type of stuff?
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Story is. This is for... And again, this category is the third category he has. It's called scientific but speculative.
Sure. I mean... I'm thinking to myself of probably Jade City is up there of, because if we're, a lot of it is our human world, but add in a couple ideas on magic and how, like, how would magic powered by Jade work? Right. And Jade. We kind of start going into craziness, but it still starts with us. There's a lot of assumptions about the world that you kind of have from our own.
Okay.
So I think that's a good blend. It's still, by our standards, it's fantasy, but I think it goes into here where it takes a lot of our world and then builds off of it. A what if.
Got it.
Other examples would be... Hyperion count?
I have one I think that's an easy example.
Okay.
Is because Hyperion, I think, is a bit different. I think Hyperion would actually go in that engineer one as well, possibly, because there's a lot of those. Would you say differently?
I would, because I don't think it's the focus.
Yeah. I would say more so it can't be this category, because in Hyperion, it focuses on the characters, like, a lot in there.
Exactly. Well, so, it doesn't focus on the engineering aspect of it, really, either. Mm. Like, it's
I see what you mean.
Do you get what I mean? Yeah. Like, yeah, it goes
it's
into
described,
this.
But yeah, the overall theme isn't the tools, I guess. Yeah. But I think this is why it wouldn't be in the first category, the drivel category. All Systems Red is, what if a robot was sentient and misanthropic and kind of went through a world and was just as off-putting but humorous and so fun than a human you would know? What if you took an AI, a robot that literally had reasons to be misanthropic, and just what if?
What would be cool? what if a robot gained sentience? What would their personality be like? How would they interact with
humans? What if they broke against the system and then they had thoughts of their own? Yeah.
Because I think maybe Martha Wells had the question or the mainly looking at other robot stories of the Lieutenant Data aspect from Star Trek of, you know, Data has sentience and like wants emotions and wants to be human. And Martha Wells asked the question, like, why? Like, I don't really think a human, a robot that gained sentience would want to be human. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should assume that.
Be grossed out by humans.
Exactly.
It's fun.
And so it takes that aspect where the robot's like, yeah, I don't want to be human. That's gross. No. So
I think that's a good one because it's very simple story structure. It's not the engineer going into it, but hey, what if that?
Sure.
And here's where C.S. Lewis says this is where this kind of story can be bad. He says, but while I think this sort of science fiction legitimate and capable of great virtues, it is not a kind which can endure copious production. It is only the first visit to the moon or to Mars that is, for this purpose, any good. After each has been discovered in one or two stories and turned out to be different in each, it becomes difficult to suspend our disbelief in favor of subsequent stories. However good they were, they would kill each other by becoming numerous.
Honestly, it's a good example with Martha Wells' All Systems Red. Hmm. I like the first book so much because the novelty of Murderbot. But as it goes on, that novelty wears off. And I like the books for different reasons, but it doesn't hit the same as the first. Kind of get what I mean?
Because at the first one, you go, oh, that's such a fun concept. The premise carries the what if. Mm-hmm. But then with All Systems Red, you'd hope, I read the second book as well, you still have the fun character.
Exactly. Which you keeps still you going. Have that, but I can see where that's not repeatable. Like, you can't do the what if a robot, you know, didn't, like, was sentient but didn't want to be human.
One trick pony.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So things like would Dune fall into this category?
No.
The reason I say that is the sequels to Dune being very not really well loved of kind of how it goes in.
I think we'll go more in that creates a world of its own category. Mm-hmm. Because which is one of the next ones, which we can talk about, because this is, actually, it's the one after this. But this one is, we can't go over this. This is the, do you have another thought on that before jumping? Okay.
That's fine.
Yeah. So this is the, I don't know how to say this word, so I'm going to have you read it off and good luck.
I'm going to butcher this one. I'm not even going to pretend to try. Eschontological.
No, there's no end there, but you know.
I can't. I quite literally see an end, but.
No, it's the, I think that, so it's the eschatological. Eschatological, maybe. Eschatological. Yeah. Jesus. So, which means, I had to look this
These
up.
These people were way smarter than us.
These people, C.S. Lewis, he should be.
Yeah. I would hope so.
These people, like, that's just...
No, just everyone. These people, everyone but us.
Yeah.
It hurts.
We're trying. I had to look this up because I didn't know what it meant. It means death, judgment, and the finality of humankind. So he's talking about stories, the subspecies of sci-fi that talks about the end.
That's a lot. Well, where Hyperion would fall into this category.
There it is.
Very much.
That's the one.
Hyperion falls here. I would say something like Brave New World is maybe close. It's close, but different. I don't know if that one really counts as much, but what are some other examples you can think of?
I have one here, Hitchhiker's Guide.
Sure.
I think it's super cool because Hitchhiker's Guide, the whole point is why?
Sure.
The end of humanity, it has a message. The end of, what is the point of this all? And so books that make you question and ask yourself the grand picture of things. Humankind, it could be an... I guess your annihilation or your, not the book Annihilation, but the end, the either doom of humanity or seeing if there's, you can kind of.
What's the point of humanity?
Yeah, you can kind of point into
what
one
is our
thing.
What is our,
our purpose?
Raison d'etre. Isn't that
I haven't heard that.
Purpose of being.
Yeah. Purpose of being. And so C.S. Lewis, he says it here. It's he says it here in just better words than we can. He says,
yes,
it is so
use the essay.
why should
we try and word it?
We're trying to dumb it down, but I think we're too dumb to dumb it down. You know,
that's true.
We're past the
a very, very smart person. A smart person can explain something to another smart person. A very smart person can explain a smart idea to a dumb person. A dumb person can't explain anything at all.
That was explained pretty well.
There we go.
Nice going.
There we go.
We're getting better. Okay. So C.S. Lewis says, it is sobering and cathartic to remember now and then our collective smallness, our apparent isolation, the apparent indifference of nature, the slow biological, geological, and astronomical processes which may, in the long run, make many of our hopes, possibly some of our fears, ridiculous. Perspective.
Neuromancer would fall into this category. Yep. There's a bunch of stories actually like that. So take just like a wild peel at the bookshelf here. Orson Scott Card does quite a bit of that. I would say
C.S. Lewis has examples such as Wells' Time Machine, Arthur Clarke's Children's End, and First Men Stapledon's. I haven't heard of this. Stapledon's Last and First Men. That's another one. So. And as we said, you gave the example of, so I was saying Hitchhiker's Guide. What was your first example you gave? It was a great one. Hyperion.
Yeah,
that's good.
Neuromancer. Jesus. Always when I'm on the spot, fail to actually rise to the occasion.
Actually, I'm noticing too, behind us, a lot more fantasy than sci-fi.
I have a lot more fantasy than sci-fi.
Huh.
I know. We need to go on more sci-fi binges.
Reading Children. Oh, I can't talk about this yet, but Children of Time, we're reviewing that.
That falls into it.
Oh, Children of Time, baby. Oh.
You'd also have probably Three Body Problem. Definitely falls into this. Just knowing I haven't even read the book, and I know it. I know the concept of the book. Yeah. It falls into that category.
Nice.
I think a lot of sci-fi nowadays that people really like falls into this. Would you say 1984 and Brave New World fall here more appropriately?
He did talk about this in the essay. I'm trying to remember where he did this. I'm forgetting. I think so.
Because it's more of a message on what's the purpose of humanity, what are we like at the end?
Maybe?
Taking that what if question.
But what if it's the prior one?
No, what's our purpose?
Yeah.
And it's more of a comment of what...
Humanity.
On humankind and our finality.
Death and finality. Maybe.
So,
because does dystopian, because I think that's where it gets muddied, where he has a different subspecies he talks about in the end. That's where I was a bit confused at the end. I hope is for this video that we're doing now too. It's we're saying on science fiction analysis of C.S. Lewis's work here. I think this is going to be useful for 5 years from now when some high school student has to read this for some class, or maybe freshman in college has to read this. They go, man, I need a summary.
I want to see where everyone else messes up, and like through them, I can correct their mistakes and therefore learn. You know what I mean?
I was going the route of maybe they find this helpful for like a school project, but no, maybe not. Okay.
Why not?
You know what's helpful for me here?
Hmm.
It, at the very least, when he was, I learned a couple words.
Oh, yeah.
I really, his, just the writing of the essays alone, really well written. Yeah. It's awesome. So do you want to go on to the fifth category?
Yeah, okay. Let's go.
The fifth is I didn't know how to label it. So I have a lot of labels because he in the first four with this essay, he makes it very clear kind of what the labels are. This one I have as the strange / fantastic / mythopoeic.
Mythopoeic.
Mythopoeic, which is the creating of a myth. And
adjacent to high fantasy.
In this, you could say he kind of talks about some subspecies from this, but I'm going to consider it one category, and then there's other things he talks about in here just to make it easier to digest for people listening for us here.
Yeah, this one.
There's a bunch he talks about.
This one was confusing to me.
Which was odd because he said this was his favorite.
Yeah.
He said, this is the one I love the most, and the one he loved the most was the most difficult to understand. And why for you? So what did you get out of it?
I guess it was hard for me to delineate what is the difference. Why is this science? Why is this a subspecies of science fiction and not just fantasy? Or is he roping this both into it? Because is the stories about mythos inherently science fiction-esque? because it's dealing with theology, or, you know, a mythology. Theology is more science fiction rather than complete fantasy. But I'm not sure. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think he at first talks about it. He starts this essay off, or he starts this paragraph off by saying it's stories about space travel, but stories. It's not stories about space travel, but stories about gods, ghosts, ghouls, demons, fairies, monsters, those type of things. And then he goes on to say, sometimes it is a postulate which liberates consequences very far from comic. And when this is so, if the story is good, it will usually point a moral or itself without any didactic manipulation by the author on the conscious level. And all that means for didactic is like, hey, is the author trying to force in a message?
Is it propaganda in the sense of telling a story for the sake of changing someone's mind?
Right. And which he says in this too, some people, a lot of readers will assume that the author was trying to write an allegory of sorts. A lot of readers will say, oh, obviously this is symbolic for this. Whereas the C.S. Lewis, and this is very important because C.S. Lewis wrote Narnia, which is seen as a massive allegory. And C.S. Lewis is saying often the authors are writing something which they don't have an exact allegory they're going for, but the readers will end up filling in their heads. That is what he says.
Narnia is allegorical, though.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
But still, that's what he says.
Okay? About other stuff.
About other stuff, yeah.
I think he does admit, like, Narnia is pretty allegorical for Christianity, so.
Oh, yeah.
He can write two different genres.
It's like a 2-to-1. It's a 200% allegory. It goes above just a 1-to-1 allegory. So it's,
yeah. But I get what you mean.
I guess what he's getting at here is he talks about in this category, and again, there's a couple he kind of talks about here. So mashing this into one big category, he says Tolkien's counts here. Mm. Lord of the Rings is in this category. His list of ones that count is McDonald's Fantasies, which is one of the books that Tolkien and C.S. Lewis were very inspired by McDonald's. I think George McDonald's is his name. Mm-hmm. And then you have include parts of the Odyssey would be included in here. The Ancient Mariner of Christabel.
Abbott's Flatland is something that our friend Dom made us both read.
Yeah.
Interesting concept. Lovely to talk about. Honestly, that would be a fun book to talk about. It was interesting to read.
Yes. And I'd say here, so then kind of putting a label on this, I guess it goes back to that mythopoeia, creating of a myth. This is the category where, yes, you mentioned there's gods, ghouls, and this, but then the bigger category he's talking about is where it's not just a what if.
Mm-hmm.
It is a complete creation of its own. Maybe in our world terms today, where we'll talk about the difference between what he's saying now and what words we use today would be considered high fantasy or high sci-fi, maybe is the word, because when we talk about high or low fantasy is Percy Jackson, Harry Potter. The normal world exists and you go to a new world. There's elements of you are taking what we know and then going a step beyond to Narnia or something like that. But then high fantasy, as we describe it, is there. It's not this earth. There's no kid in a school. It is straight up, you start with a character in a world that is completely different and then from there.
Is it mainly that he is ascribing to it the science fiction, I guess, label in the sense that it must be created. There is a machine. Even though it is fantastical in nature, the Lord of the Rings needed a certain level of coherence and creation to be able to make it all work coherently. Making it all work together versus a lower form of fantasy more just assumes a lot of things. It's like that's kind of the difference between a high fantasy and low fantasy, where a low fantasy leans on a lot of assumptions from our own world and high fantasy has to explain.
Like Martian is low fantasy. Sci-fi.
Yeah, exactly. Martian would be engineering, but low sci-fi because you don't have to make a lot of assumptions. Mm-hmm. Well, you do make a lot of assumptions. It's basically everything except the idea of Mars having storms that have winds that are capable of pushing over a rocket. Yeah. That is the only fantastical, really, nature. I think that and maybe some small other things, but other than that, you could assume it's the real world.
And then whereas Fire Upon the Deep, as we mentioned, that is would be high sci-fi, if that's even a term. Because for this, he's saying specifically that, okay, I'll quote him a couple times to kind of bring us back to his point. He says, in this story of pseudo-scientific apparatus, that's how he puts it, is to be taken simply as a machine in the sense that the word bore for the neoclassical critics, the most superficial appearance of plausibility, the mere sop to our critical intellect will do. And he goes on. So, again, he's talking about a couple things here because he talks about there's the gods, ghosts, ghouls, demons, fairies, monsters, those kind of stories, and then the mythopoeic, that's how you say the word, where it's creating a myth of its own. So he's talking about multiple things. I think he's going on a spectrum of, look, maybe he's kind of distinguishing between a low and high sci-fi or fantasy here. He's talking about, okay, here's the ones that are use familiar. Actually, maybe that's exactly what he's getting at.
Mm-hmm.
Because he starts this part talking about gods, ghost ghouls that are taking from something that exists, not just asking the what if, which is in another subspecies of his, but isn't going, hey, what if this existed? But it's taking a fairy tale of sorts of, look at this, there's fairies exist and there's sirens out there and like a Norse mythology. It's kind of taking, it's taking some mythos and going off on its own as a low sci-fi, low fantasy. And then he's distinguishing that from the mythopoeic, which is creating an entire mythos of your own. So maybe he's just distinguishing in this last part between taking a little inspiration from things that are myths in the world versus creating your own myth.
I guess so.
You think so?
I think, but then again, I think that this then incorporates all of fantasy. Fantasy then all falls into this genre.
I think that's what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
I think.
Maybe it's applying the idea of like pseudo-scientific process to create these fantastical worlds.
Yeah.
That a properly constructed fantasy world operates at a level of logic that is scientific in nature, that Tolkien put, it's not complete nonsense, that it requires a level of logic and construction that is borders on the scientific.
Okay.
Is it more of the process of creation rather than?
It could be, I think.
Something else?
Yeah, I'm just, so it would be curious to know, I guess, but because C.S. Lewis, when he's writing this on science fiction, I think the definition from then to today, a lot of what he's saying would include fantasy.
Yeah. I don't know how we could include Narnia as science fiction. That's a weird thing to think about.
But C.S. Lewis has written some purely science fiction books too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, to us, Narnia is fantasy. To us, Lord of the Rings is fantasy, but he includes Lord of the Rings in this example for the mythopoeic. He includes it in this on science fiction topic, and I think for him, the definition then to now, we would use fantasy in our definition of impossible versus improbable.
Mm-hmm.
He's not using that.
No.
He's analyzing something very different, which maybe what you're getting at is it uses some sort of...
I'm trying to think. Yeah, I guess he's saying, what else? What fantasy would not qualify under this definition?
Maybe his definition too. He's looking more at speculative fiction than science fiction. He's including both sci-fi and fantasy in this.
The best way to define a group is to identify what it excludes.
Mm-hmm.
That's generally how, like that. That's what defines a group.
You hang out with me all the time. You don't exclude me.
I don't exclude
you.
I'm defined by me not excluding you.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you classify the difference of, like, what makes a Christian. Like,
yeah,
they exclude people that don't believe, you know, Jesus Christ is the Lord and Savior. That they are defined by the exclusion.
Gatekeeping.
That's you can't be Christian. You can't say, oh, I'm Christian, but also Jesus isn't the Son of God. Those don't mix. And so you are excluded.
Mm-hmm.
So in this, what type of fantasy would be excluded from his definition here?
That's where I think he keeps it loose to cover everything else. I think he's trying to encapsulate everything else he didn't include and what he loves the most.
This would be the best part for people in the comments to maybe, if they understand it better than us, which I'm assuming someone out there does, I hope, could explain that to us, and it'd be a lovely discussion in the comments about this part in particular, but anything else as well, you know.
I wish we had Philip Chase on for this. This would have been...
Yeah, that would have been nice.
This would have been great.
We could use that PhD energy.
We could. Let us know if you have, reading this essay at the end here, if you have any other thoughts on it, because after getting to those definitions, he then has a point here to make of people who dislike this subspecies. This subspecies, which we're kind of defining, it seems like he's going for, won't repeat ourselves, but anything you want to add about what we think it is? Because I think we got to the extent of our...
We can't really...
That's what we got.
That's all we have, and I don't think we are doing it justice. We are confused and would appreciate external help on it.
Yes. I think until I get more information, I think he's trying to distinguish low versus high. And like that's what I think it is, but we'll see. Because he says here, people who dislike this, that he's talking about this fifth category that goes into subcategories, he says, I would like to draw attention to a neglected fact. The astonishing intensity of the dislike which some readers feel for the mythopoeic, the creating of those kind of stories. I first found it out by accident. A lady had been talking about a dreariness which seemed to be creeping over her life, the drying up in her of the power to feel pleasure, the aridity of her mental landscape. Drawing a bow at a venture, I asked, "Have you any taste for fantasies and fairy tales?" I shall never forget how her muscles tightened, her hands clenched themselves, her eyes started as if with horror, and her voice changed, and she hissed out, "I loathe them." Clearly, we here have to do not with a critical opinion, but with something like a phobia. And I have seen traces of it elsewhere, though never quite so violent. On the other side, I know from my own experience that those who like the mythopoeic like it with almost equal intensity. The two phenomena taken together should at least dispose of the theory that it is something trivial. I love how he says that for a couple things. It kind of gives some insight. On one hand, in 1955, think about how unpopular or weird sci-fi fantasy was. Think of the kind of negative flack you'd get.
But it's starting to be a bit more popular, which is why he talks about it in this essay of, basically, because it's starting to become more popular, critics are now more aware of it and more high. They're more negative on it, even though that the genre itself is starting to improve in aspect where the quality and quantity are both increasing versus, you know, where were the critics when it was a much smaller genre in a much worse state. But now that it's popular and improving in quality, now it's time to, you know, lay on the criticism and the hate, which is interesting. I think that's applicable today. Really, I mean, I think romanticism is definitely that budding genre within the past couple of years. It used to be a much smaller type of subgenre and now is increasing in popularity. And so now we have a higher quantity and, I am assuming, quality. Again, not my genre, so I can't really comment on it. But I'm assuming it does.
Superhero stuff.
Oh, definitely. I mean, same thing of when it became more popular, more mainstream, that's when the critics actually came out more in full about it, even though it got
better.
That's when
you got your, fun of them?
You don't see you don't see much criticism of superhero movies back during, you know, when Blade came out, and Blade's pretty good. But all those, you know, first superhero movies, it's, you know, it's not that good, but people
let the nerds have their fun, you
know? Let their nerds have their fun. Then MCU takes over, and now everyone's critical, even though Captain America Winter Soldier, pretty great. And overall, the quality got generally better.
Yeah.
I would say now it's gotten significantly worse, but I digress.
I just think it's really good insight at the time where C.S. Lewis starts this essay by talking about how critics are now attacking his favorite thing, and he had a conversation with somebody that just has this visceral reaction to sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Just kind of to see how much progress has been made where sci-fi fantasy, like, you're lame if you don't read sci-fi fantasy.
That's true.
If you don't,
you're
participate in my hobby. Mm-hmm. Loser.
Failure. Absolute common drivel.
Oh, I thought you were going like common whore. I thought you were going to just add like an unexpected insult in there.
Yeah, no, I just go straight to the whore. just I need to come up with an
insult.
Rack my brain. Whore. There we go. Got it.
So that, I think that's pretty cool to look at, because for us, I think our generation's cool factor was when the Lord of the Rings movies came out. It opened the floodgates. Fantasy's cool. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Peter Jackson and Tolkien, of course. I think that set a tone for the 21st century of we're coming out. Yeah. Cosplays now are very common, and
you
not just
about
common,
kind
but
of stuff.
Yeah.
Fantasy video games are now actually mainstream thing. Like you're kind of, I remember those times of like, you're weird if you play video games. And to be fair, even in my childhood, it was like, I was in that in-between stage of it started to become less weird if you played video games, even when I was young. Like I remember that shift of, hey, you play video games? Oh, you're weird. You're kind of a loser. And then it switched to like, yeah, everyone plays video games.
Yeah.
It's commonplace and it's not a weird thing to do. Yeah. Same thing with anime is one of those things of you were the weirdo. And to be fair, the kids who liked anime when they were young, you weren't weird because you liked anime. You were weird because you were running around the playground running like Naruto. That's why you were weird. Those are two different things.
Ah, okay.
Very different.
But now even the Naruto thing isn't as weird as it was 20 years ago.
It's still weird. We had people running like Naruto against Area 51.
See? The Overton window ever expands to where what will happen one day? What is a weird thing now that won't be weird 25 years from now? Maybe?
No, nope, I don't like that. I'm not a fan.
What is something that's weird today? Plenty. Furries. 20 years from now, people, you can finally let your hobby be known. So you can actually go out there and let people understand, like, hey, you don't have to hide it anymore.
I hate you. I do hope that that's not. Let's hope. We can hope that that stays niche. Just corner it off on the internet.
It's the thing of it. You know what? Before we get into another 5-minute rant about furries, we've done that plenty of times.
Weird thought. Like, yeah. Went down a rabbit hole of like it came across my feed talking about how there's a weird correlation between furries and software engineers. Like a lot of them. All tech support. Like,
really?
Yeah. Like during furry conventions, like tech support goes down. Like, which I don't know how true that is. But I like to believe it.
It's the internet. It's true.
I'm not going to research that any further. I'm just going to go along.
The belief satisfies your desire to want to believe it. Exactly. It makes you happier believing in it.
I like to believe that the frustrating people over at tech support, that a large majority of them are furries. That makes sense in my world.
So encapsulating this.
What if? What if all people in tech support were actually furries?
Sci-fi.
There we go.
You just made a sci-fi book.
I made sci-fi book.
So encapsulating this analysis, this very educated analysis on C.S. Lewis and on science fiction, let's end it with not furries. You know, let's loop this back to...
Sure, we can try.
This is the ending of the essay, and I think it leaves us with a very thought-provoking thing to talk about, okay?
Right.
This is his final paragraph. This is his message, and he says this. Kind of loops this back around to criticism again. He says, "For I am convinced that good adverse criticism is the most difficult thing we have to do. I would advise everyone to begin it under the most favorable conditions. This is where you thoroughly know and heartily like the thing the author is trying to do and have enjoyed many books where it was done well. Then you will have some chance of really showing that he has failed and perhaps even of showing why. But if our real reaction to a book is, oh, I just can't bear this sort of thing, then I think we shall not be able to diagnose whatever the real faults it has. We may, we may lab our to conceal our emotions, We may labor to conceal our emotions, but we shall end in a welter of emotive, unanalyzed, vogue words such as facetious, bogus, adolescent, immature, and the rest. When we really know what is wrong, we need none of these."
Yeah. I think that's really why we liked our, I like doing the Romantasy podcast with the Fantasy Fangirls.
Yeah.
Is they were able to properly analyze something that which
we can't.
We can't.
Yeah.
We can have fun with it. We can't properly criticize it.
But we're reading it going, ugh, and rolling our eyes. We're giving these exact words, which are, hey, when we look at it and go, oh my God, another one of these, we're not able to actually look at it with a lens that he would say, you, to have good criticism, you have to enjoy things in that genre to compare to when it was done well.
Yeah.
When we talked about subjective versus objective quality of works, we're talking about the term subjective universality, where if a bunch of people see an issue with something, doesn't mean it's objectively wrong, but usually there's something about it that a lot of humans are going, something's off about Game of Thrones season 8, something's off about da-da-da. And when you get to that point, that subjective universality, usually the critics themselves that criticize something, why there's some value in critics is... Not all critics, you know, us, where we are depends on the book we're reviewing.
Well, the critics that are valuable are the ones that agree with us.
Exactly. So that's the thing. When you can be a critic and somebody that has seen a bunch of movies, read a bunch of books in a specific genre, then can go have a little bit more insight. Maybe you won't agree with their opinions because you have different tastes, but they can at least go, hey, I've seen 1,000 stories done this way. And this one does it the best of those 1,000 stories. I'd rather listen to that person than somebody that's read 2 books, unless one of those 2 books was Red Rising and they loved it. Then they just happen to read the best already.
Yeah,
and they don't have to read anymore. When you start at the top, there's no reason to go down.
Yeah.
That's my analysis.
Well, it follows the same thing of good criticism.
Yeah.
When you're taking criticism from someone, you want to take it from someone with good intent. And you can only have good intent if they are looking for what is your goal, and they want the same thing as you. So if you're criticizing a genre, they want you to succeed at the genre, which means they like the genre. If they don't like the genre at all, they're not even looking for you to succeed at the goal you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's not good criticism.
It's what makes bad art, too, when all of our adaptations we see, if sometimes there's an artist... The Witcher team, or somebody is a part of a project where they are not invested, or they don't like the thing they're making, or they're doing it because, hey, it's another superhero movie. In one case, it's another one of these. Often those can come up as really bad, and just not, there's not a love to it. There's just a kind of corporate vibe that you're just going, man, you know what? At least George Lucas with the first 3, they're bad movies, but at least it seemed like he cared.
There was a heart.
There was a heart. Okay. Yeah. You can't write dialogue for the life of you, but there, you tried. And I respect that you tried with these bad movies versus then you go, okay,
it has episode to come 9. From a, it has to then, come from a place of love and understanding for you to actually give good criticism on it and for any kind of analysis.
Yeah.
There you go.
That was On Science Fiction by C.S. Lewis. How did you like that? Going over essays and analyzing
I feel
stuff.
Like we really exposed our ignorance, but I had fun doing it.
I had fun because, you know, I learned a lot today.
Yeah.
In the discussion.
But I learned
some. What did you all think? Let us know if you want more of these kind of essay reviews where we kind of interweave between analyzing / looking for if you guys have any thoughts on it. Should be fun.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll see you next episode with another, not another one of these. We'll wait a little bit, see what the reception is, if we should continue.
It'll probably be another Sanderson review. Yeah. Let's be honest.
But I got to say, if this does well or not, I like this. I want to do more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now it's time to do a whole video on Voltaire. Let's just jump right into
it. They think we're joking.
I know, they think we're joking.
Time to get into some philosophy. See you, everybody.
Bye, y'all.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.